This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. It seems to me that there were too many losses in the poetry world in the year 2016. One of the hardest came on the last day of the year, when my friend David Meltzer died as the result of a stroke. Meltzer appeared at the Word Temple Poetry Series in Sonoma County twice over the years, first with Diane DePrima when he was celebrating his selected poems, David's Copy, and then when with his wife, Julie Rogers, when his book, With City Lights, When I Was a Poet, was released. Between those two events, I had the chance to meet with David occasionally for lunch in Oakland. He was, as DePrima put it, one of the secret treasures on our planet. Great poet, musician, comic, mystic, unsurpassed performer with few peers. Once the shock of David's death became something more like acceptance, memories of his readings, the shared music we loved, and his light, I guess what some people would call his aura, began to comfort. It seemed to me that the man was always smiling, even when we spoke with difficulties in the world. Meltzer, exuding a spirit of playfulness, seemed to find humor, be it humor with a sharp edge. He's probably somewhere joking about his own death right now. I don't want to spend too much time talking about David Meltzer. I'd rather have you experience him yourself through some recordings I made over the years. Over the next hour, you'll hear an interview I conducted with him at his Oakland home in March of 2007, part of a reading he gave at the Beat Museum in February of 2007. The recording quality isn't great, but it's still worth it just so you can hear him in that environment. And some music he recorded with his late wife, Tina. They had a group called Serpent Power. And finally, music by Kathleen Ferrier, who is someone we both deeply admired, talked about her a lot, shared music and books. Here's a quote. "When I was a poet, everything was possible. There wasn't anything that wasn't possible." That's from When I Was a Poet by David Meltzer. Let's move on now to the interview recorded on March 15th, 2007. This is Catherine Hastings with Word Temple. My guest today is David Meltzer, author of many books, including Beat Thing, David's Copy, San Francisco Beat, Talking with the Poets, No Eyes, Lester Young, and Reading Jazz, a comprehensive historical anthology of writings on jazz by African-American musicians, critics, writers, and poets. Welcome, David.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your past first. You grew up in Brooklyn, but you moved to L.A. in 1954.
Yes.
And I recently interviewed beat poet Michael McClure, and he told me how he first met poets like Robert Duncan and Kenneth Rexroth when he came to San Francisco in the 50s. How did you make your way into the scene in San Francisco?
Well, I got to San Francisco via L.A. in 1957, and I was a lad, and had come up from Los Angeles with the painter Wallace Berman. He was going to just stay the weekend visiting friends, and I was I had a job offering working in a book warehouse, and the person who was managing the book warehouse let me stay in his place on Larkin Street, which was a it had been like a radio repair shop that had then been converted into this desolate, you know, ground floor apartment with the store windows papered up, and I slept in the window, and he slept on a cot. I mean, there were very little facilities, a sink and a toilet, you know, and then that was about it. I never left. I mean, I've been there.
You're still in the window.
Yeah, still, you know, it's like 50 years now. 50 years, my God, yes.
Well, we won't count.
No.
Well, I want to come back to it, but let's start off with a poem. Let's give someone a poem to listen to right off. What would you like to read?
Okay. just a very simple poem. It's called It's Simple. It's simple. One morning, wake up ready for new work. Pet the dog. Dog's not there. Rise and shine. Sun's not there. Take a deep breath. No air. Look for the sun. No sun. It's simple. Wake up one morning ready for new work, and the animals are on strike with the air, the sea, the earth quits us, casts us off like a sickness in her fiery core.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Well, in your bio, you say that you fell into the North Beach cultural revolution, which became too quickly co-opted by media and the tendency to one-dimensionalize dissidents into defanged, cuddly types like Maynard G. Krebs. It's a humorous statement, but not entirely.
Untrue. And in fact, you know, over the intervening decades, as the kind of mythologizing of all of this gets mm-hmm. further and further away from the very serious historical and social tensions that were really going on at that point, it becomes more and more now just almost like a fantasy of a movement, and the only way you can realize your involvement with it is by consuming. You know, there are all of these artifacts and objects and so forth.
Right, we're going to be playing a portion from your reading at the Beat Museum.
Yes, and I vowed never to go there, and there I did. And what happened? I was laid up with the flu for 2 weeks afterwards. So
the beat
virus.
Well, there are beets hanging everywhere from the walls in that place.
God, yes, like wombats.
Yeah. During your reading, I think you playfully referred to the museum as the Costco for beet redemption.
Well, you know, I'm not responsible for what I say.
It was great.
Thank you.
Well, many of your poems reveal the importance of music in your life.
Yes.
And it goes way back to your childhood. Your mother was a harpist and your father was a cellist.
That's right.
And I was wondering if you would read Sonnet 6.
Sure, of course. Oh, you have it there.
I do. Yeah. Here you go.
Thank you.
It's a lovely poem.
Thank you. My father becomes my angel, watching me write poems about Zohar and the music of clouds. I see him practicing his cello in the middle of the living room, sleeves rolled up, shirt open, pulls the bow across the strings with fury. I see him angry at me as I am now angry with my daughters. My father is my angel, watching over me like a piano teacher. We never understood each other, that we were different, that we were the same, strangers with the same face. We never understood we were the same, we were different. And now he is my angel, watching over me as I write to you and sing his name. And we are not so different, are we, you and me and my father?
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Going back to music, you wrote a book-length poem for Lester Young, No Eyes, and and you have short poems or references to people in your poems like Hank Williams and Billie Holiday and Thelonious Monk, and I was hoping you'd talk for a minute about your relationship between jazz and poetry.
Well, that's one of those epical detours, but I think around 1945 or 46, when I first heard the music that was called bebop, I'd been raised in a household of musicians and a household that was just one whole bookshelf was just filled with 78s in no particular order or category. There was jazz, popular music, classical music, you name it, albums, singles, and so forth. And as a kid, I just had access to all of that and never really made the distinction between one kind of music or another kind of music, in a sense, was just music to me. And I just listened to things that I liked over and over again. And then I remember going to a summer camp in Maine, against my will, by the way.
Oh, really?
I didn't want to go, but I was sort of sent away from home because my grandfather, who I loved immensely, was dying, and he was dying in my room.
How old were you then?
I was, probably 11, 10, 10 or 11, and I was not camp material. And I remember one time when everyone was down at the old swimming hole, and I was still on campus. The workers who worked in the kitchen staff, began playing Dizzy Gillespie and so forth that went through the camp speaker system.
Wow, that's some music for a kids' camp.
Yeah, no, but I mean, that was because no one was there.
Right,
they were basically
right.
playing for themselves, and I said, wow, you know, what's going on? So I went down to the mess hall, I guess you call it, and started going there every afternoon, hanging out, listening to these guys play this music, which was I'd never really heard. And it's like when everybody, I think every generation, I don't know anyone who doesn't say something about my music. You know, like there are kids who will say, well, punk, my music, or,
yes.
you know, heavy, my music, and then so bebop for some reason was my music, and I got back, and my father, had been a professional cellist, but in his sort of middle age, he made a break, actually, and became like another kind of creative person altogether. He became like a comedy writer for radio.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and but he had, as they say in the parlance, he had big ears. In other words, he listened to everything, and he heard. You know, I came back from camp babbling about this new music, so he took me down to Manhattan to 52nd Street to a place called Bop City, and subsequently to a place called Birdland, which was named after Charlie Parker. But in those days, Charlie Parker was still alive and playing there, and New York had this very sort of tolerant nightclub law that if you were underage, you could sit in a kind of, I don't know what you call it, but some sort of holding pattern, drink Coke and have sandwiches. Uh-huh. But you could listen to the music all night
That's
long.
That's fantastic.
So, I went with my dad and we listened, we heard Parker, Monk, Miles, Davis, Bud Powell, you name it, they were there. And then a few years later, when I was living with my father in a hotel on 48th Street, I would go every time I could. I'd go to the Monday jam sessions and so forth. So anyway, that was. So I've always been listening to the music but I've always been listening to all kinds of music. I mean, because of my early initiation to just music, I didn't.
Right.
So anyway.
Well, going to that camp,
yeah.
Something you didn't want to do turned out to be pretty wonderful.
Indeed.
Well, would you read something from your long poem, Beat Thing? Because I know you've got bebop in language in this poem.
Right? Yeah, I'm just trying to. I have nothing in particular. You don't mind if I zap through? Do you want me to read funny stuff or
what are you in the mood for?
it's also difficult. The the structure of the book is. Basically, I think the first 40-some-odd pages is the main text, and then the next 70 or 80 pages is commentary on the main text. I can read you. I can start off with the beginning commentary. It's there anyway. Sorry to be so
That's okay.
swimmingly inarticulate about my own work. It's hard talking about your own work. Mm-hmm. It's much easier often just reading it but then, all right, beat thing, a commentary. It was the bomb, Shoah. It was void, spirit, crisis, disconnect. No subject but blank, unrelenting, busted time. No future, suburban expand into past, present, nuclear, get it, family. Droids, Pavlov, minutia. It was Jews with blues, reds, nulled and jolted. Ethel and Julius, brain smoke, pyre of shoes and eyeglasses. Weeping black GIs open bells and gates. Things are going to look different when you get outside. Understand that beforehand. This book doesn't kid you. And don't forget the third effect, radioactivity, the power to shoot off invisible atomic rays. Even if the all clears sounded, don't rush to leave the safe place. Geiger counts, light leaks from ash, hand reaches up for your eyes. Yes, the atomic bomb is a terrible weapon, but not as terrible as most of us believe. Tillich tells us it's the destiny of historical man to be annihilated, not by a cosmic event, but by the tensions in his own being and history.
That's great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Robert Duncan said, quote,
okay,
poets are like magpies. They grab at anything bright and they take it back to their nest and they'll use it sooner or later. And indeed, having written a good number of poems as collages, you call yourself a poet with a taste for pilfering.
Yes, yes. Robert inspired me. I mean, the great thing about mentors and teachers is they're one of their main functions is they give you permission, you know. In other words, they acknowledge, they give you permission to do what you're going to do anyway. But coming from someone like Robert, who is such an extraordinary person and such a, you know, sort of a major figure in a major exemplar, you know, in my life, and Robert and when the poetics program at New College first started, mm-hmm. Robert was sort of like the center of it. And then,
so that's how you met him? Was that
New College? I knew him way before that. I mean, he was part of. Well, first he'd been part of what they call the Berkeley Renaissance, mm-hmm. People like Jack Spicer, Mary Fabelli, William Everson, and so on. But lived in San Francisco with his partner Jess, who was a
wonderful collagist.
Wonderful collagist, and a very sweet man. Yeah. They couldn't have been more completely opposite. You know, Jess was almost pathologically shy, and Robert was almost pathologically sociable, overt, you know, and so forth. During the first 5 years of the poetics program, Robert was dying of some sort of liver disease. But I think being there with the students and just in that culture sustained his life a little longer, and he certainly amazingly, you know, taught them about dying in a way that was another lesson, you know, that that teachers do. He had this sort of bag attached to it was like a dialysis.
Dialysis.
And we'd have these collective classes once a week where all the faculty and all the student body of the program would meet each week to discuss, you know, various things like the page, rhythm, you know, line ends, mm-hmm. this kind of thing. And you know, Robert, whose mind was so incredibly febrile and in motion, he'd be rattling away, and then would have to unplug the bag because it had filled up. And so he'd be talking, he'd unplug the bag, flop it on the table.
Oh my gosh.
Students' jaws would drop, and Robert would just keep on talking, and then plug in a new one. You know,
don't mind a body, folks.
No, that was it. He was a remarkable man. And yes, he's the one that said about the magpies, they're thieves. And of course, all art, you know, in a sense, is you could say it's theft, or you could just say it's continuity,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Really.
Absolutely.
And Robert, of course, one of his great, I suppose, instructions was curiosity. You know, he always got depressed when students were not curious.
I mean, it does indicate they're not willing to learn a whole lot.
Well, they just weren't interested, you know. And he gave me a photograph that his sister had taken of him, and his sister called him Owl because he was so, you know, so curious, and you know, and had his nose into everything. He was a remarkable man, and I'm, you know, it's sad. I'm sad to tell you that at the program that in a sense he was like the major presence in. No one studies his work these days.
I know.
You know, isn't that
it's
something?
It's really wrong. His work is amazing.
And I have I have a big issue with the UC California Press, you know, that's been sitting on the project to publish like Robert's complete works in several volumes. This has been going on for 15 years and nothing has come out, you know. So his work is gradually more and more unavailable, and
it's a shame.
Yeah.
Hopefully that will change.
Well, I hope so, too.
You get a bigger hammer, my mother would say.
Yes. Yeah, but, of course, also, you know, just as an old geezer, I mean, you see how things return. So, I mean, I know that there'll be re-interest in his work, as is there in Jack Spicer's work, you know. Jack and Robert were very close, and just like Jess and Robert, you couldn't find two more opposite people, you know.
They say opposites attract.
Well, I guess so. Yes.
And what about Rex Roth? You had a good relationship.
Did indeed. You know, as part of the young poets of my generation, like you, Michael McClure and people like Lou Welch and Joanne Kiger and so forth. Rex Roth, you know, we always thought we were above Rex Roth. He would have this Sunday radio show from KPFA, and he did sound sort of like W.C. Fields in a way, you know, and we would sit there, you know, laughing, you know, and so forth. But then I was contracted to do this book of interviews for Ballantine Books in the 60s, I believe. And it was called San Francisco Poets. And I went to Rex Roth at that point was living with his last wife, a woman named Carol Tinker, who was a poet too and quite good. They were living in the Santa Barbara, the Isla Vista area. Rex Roth was teaching at UC Santa Barbara, and apparently this was the first teaching job, you know, a regular teaching job that Rex Roth ever had. And he was like in his, I don't know, like late 60s, early 70s. It was hard to tell because he was such a vital presence. But anyway, I came to their house. They couldn't have been more gracious. And already I was beginning to feel, you know, sort of embarrassed for all the bad thoughts I'd had. And I was carrying, contrary to this miniature tape, I was carrying one of these what was called a portable reel-to-reel tape machine, you know, which weighed about 100 pounds, and I put the reel-to-reel, the tape in, clicked on the microphone, and for 2 days, Rex Roth proceeded to just, you know, talk.
Fantastic.
And it was fantastic, and I realized, you know,
this is not W.C. Fields.
No, and I also realized how much he did know, indeed, you know, and in fact, I was beginning to get kind of scared. I mean, I thought, Jesus, he knows everything. I mean, you know, there's nothing left to know. No, he was wonderful and was very supportive of my late wife Tina and I. We were musicians. We made, you know, we performed. We made some records, and he wrote the liner notes for an album that got released only like 20 or some odd years, you know, afterwards. But he was a great supporter of he helped me my first New York press book was through the agency of Kenneth Rexroth. It was published by McGraw-Hill, and he wrote the introduction to it. He was a remarkable man, again, the likes of which we don't see these days, you know. I mean, because of he came from a particular time, a particular generation, a particular set of concerns and involvement with politics and international literature. You know, he was like a polyglot, like Jack Hirschman. He translated from about three different languages, where Jack, I think, translates from about 20 different languages. Yeah.
Well,
I translate from English.
Sometimes I can do that too. Sometimes. Right. Well, when you read at the Beat Museum on February 24th, you read a wonderful poem called "The Red Shoes," and I'm going to play that recording from the Beat Museum at the end of the show. But I was wondering, you know, where did that particular poem come from? It's just so fabulous.
All right. I mean, it's first of all, my first exposure to the Red Shoes was in the 50s. There was a movie called The Red Shoes, done by Michael Powell, the director, and written by his partner Emmerich Pressburger, and it starred Moira Shearer, who was one of the leading ballerinas with the Sadler Wells Ballet Company. It was a movie about ballet, but it was a retelling of a fairy tale. A rather grim Grimm's fairy tale about a woman who puts on enchanted red shoes and can't stop dancing. And in the fairy tale, what they do is they finally have to cut off her feet. You know?
Must not dance.
Yes, you know. So the movie was in this particular kind of heartbreaking technicolor, which you don't see today. I mean, just rich and incredibly intense colors. And one of my sisters, the one who's like 2 years younger than I came from a household of basically like a mother and three sisters. My father is always away at work, so it was, anyway, she took to her bed after seeing this movie.
Wow.
My sister Nan literally was just, she was so devastated by this movie.
And how old was she when she saw this movie?
Well, she was maybe 12 or so.
Yeah.
what with the onset of puberty and this movie, I mean, she the movie was fascinating to me because it was this it was the idea in those days that if you were going to be an artist, you couldn't be a civilian. You couldn't you couldn't really get married and do that. I mean, that was sort of one of the underlying principles of the movie. You had to either give your life to your art.
You have to suffer.
That's right. But you can't have any pleasure beyond, you know, your art. Mm-hmm. And then you get punished if you try to choose like a domestic life.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it was very true. It may have been Anderson actually who wrote that, because Anderson of the fairy tale writers was the one that was most weirdly moral in a particular kind of strict Danish, Calvinist or some sort of, you know, way. And so always had his tales are often like have these horrid endings, and usually it's young women that are saying something is like legs chopped off or, you know,
pricked by a needle and
something,
you know, something happens.
Or something horrible
let's read these to our kids.
Right, because they deviated. Well, no, the fairy tale children's literature sets out to contain and to civilize, you know. That's why even where the wild things are.
That's
right, to tame, to civilize.
Yes.
But even the Sendak, you know, where the wild things are, he still nevertheless does all of that and yet returns home in time for mom to bring him supper.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so all is well in the world.
Right.
Well, The Red Shoes is just a joyous poem. So.
Thank you. Well, anyway, what I did then with that image is then sort of try to translate it somewhat to North Beach at the time I was living with... We were living in this apartment on Jones Street between Filbert and Union, and it was like probably one of the second steepest hills in San Francisco. We were living right in the center of that, and there were three daughters and very young, and so in a sense, out of that domestic situation, try to apply a retelling of the movie version of the retelling of the fairy tale.
Okay.
And so that's what
okay.
sort of it's all about.
Great.
It's a homage.
Well, I'm going to start playing a little bit from that reading
okay.
now. And David,
okay.
thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad I restrained myself.
Oh, no, we don't want that.
Yes.
This is Catherine Hastings, and I've been speaking with David Meltzer, author of Beat Thing, David's Copy, and many other books. Thank you again.
Oh, thank you, Catherine.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. You've been listening to an interview I conducted with the late poet David Meltzer. It was recorded in February of 2007. And we're going to move on now to a recording of David reading at the Beat Museum in San Francisco. And this also took place in February of 2007. The recording isn't great. I didn't have great equipment at that time, but it's definitely worth a listen. Here's David Meltzer at the Beat Museum.
Thank you, poetry lovers. This doesn't work, right?
Right. No,
so I can't look for the sweet spot. Is that right?
No. You're in the sweet spot.
I'm in
you
the
can,
sweet spot.
But...
Thank you.
That's the portal of eternity.
This actually last week was Michael and my birthday on the 17th.
Ah.
Uh-huh. So right away you're in for deception. let me see. Unprepared as I am to speak in public, I will try to riffle through my tattered manuscripts, wine-soaked and coffee-stained. You know, when I think about, like, Beat Museum, I think of, like, Madame Tussauds, you know, and I can see all these wax figurines, and then I can see, like, a side trade in these little candle wax figurines for Beat Voodoo, you know. let's melt them all down, for Christ. Hey, my God. This is David's bag. It's the bag I'm in, to paraphrase the late, great James Brown.
Has he been buried yet?
Well, of course it does. Time takes us back. I mean, I wish time would take us a little forward. I'm getting a little tired of all this backwardness, aren't you?
Yes.
I mean, you know, like,
no,
I mean,
really.
Yeah, friggin' break. I'm looking through the stuff. I love looking through the old tattered, ink-stained, wine-stained manuscripts. Let me see. All right, this is like a little simple poem. It's called Life Online. Is that okay? You know what I'm saying? Right, okay. Life Online, as I've known it, now I don't own it. It owns me. Lined up against perp wall, scanned by another anonymous eye. Ooh. Whoever I am is irregardless and decreased by false diction. Email nails nothing down. appropriate continuity for nothing happening in the flaming edges of planetary suicide. Patricide, matricide, fratricide, genocide. Whose side are you on and why? Futures, medieval, and past has passed, and now glory's icon is Adam naked in Iraq prison candid camera. Get down, go down, Moshe and Mohammed. Tangle with nude Yeshua, poked and shocked and porked by apple pie GIs. Holy, holy war, whores, victims and rictus, seized embryo fist. Losing the capacity to be human in whatever deep gloss and glaze that keyword celebrates. Electric lines plug into hooded, naked man on display in Bloomingdale's. Hopeful nightingales too shocked to sing. War smut known as power boner. We live in the shoe of the few whose foot flattens us each time they step down. I would have been a fool, but bite-sized down to a clown who amuses, not confuses. Online, all the clues stun and dun the rage. Online, like a shiny fish caught. Online for the cool shay, for the hot new. Online, cell or DSL, affordable integer of where you belong and prefer to stay and pay for, and some can pray to and pray, which is their privilege. Class apartheid defines U.S. democracy aristocrassness. Mimes and mines, masks and masks, power plays and ploys, oys and veys, yo and ho, who all go nowhere beyond the loop, they loop, which girds and binds all to no forward, untoward, hamster wheel, real deal. This is the Beat Museum, after all. Remember, it was a dissident movement. It wasn't a consumer enterprise. It was anti-consumerism, for Christ's sake, you know, and now suddenly it becomes like the fetish. It's all dead and stuff. Soil, do you have a copy of the Mr. Peanut poem somewhere around? This just came out today. It's hot off the press, and it's specifically written for Michael McClure, who I think copies are available for consumers. I mean, this is like the Beat supermarket, you know. I mean, this is like Costco for Beat redemption. So here I am. Look, I'm wearing this thing. Downbeat, you know. Forget the musical connotation. I'm saying downbeat, you know. Go away. Come back some other day, you know. Or the PTL club or something like that. Hi, I was a beatnik. Okay, this is Mr. Peanut, dedicated to Michael McClure. Old friend from God knows when. I mean, that's it, you know. Here we are. We're just stuck with God knows when. We don't look the same now. What happened? All right. So here we go.
You're listening to a recording of the late poet David Meltzer reading at the Beat Museum in San Francisco. and he was getting ready to read his Mr. Peanut poem, which is just a wonderful poem, when a whole lot of street noise and background noise came on that we just can't have on the radio. So I hate it, but I can't air his reading of that poem. Look it up. You'll enjoy it. And now I'm just going to return to the rest of his reading.
I've never been in it for the money, you know? I mean, from the outset. It was such a great relief. At 11 o'clock, or 11 years old, I started writing poetry. And it just came through me, and I figured, wow, this is incredible. There is no money that can, there's no equivalent for the experience of this transmission. And so it was a great relief. I didn't have to worry about making a living. You know, that was out of the question. I mean, what, everyone wants to make a living? Everyone should live, you know?
Yeah, right.
This is what happens when you get ancient. You are whatever. I mean, I'm art. So Michael was working on this one, Bark, a polemic.
Did you start at the beginning?
You want me to read it from
yeah.
the beginning?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. How can I beat the groove?
Go listen to that one.
All right, this is it. All right, I think I'll read the entire book to you tonight.
Okay.
Bring sleeping bags, pillows, and, you know, like crack or, you know, whatever. Okay, I ran one down. Now car-chasing dogs cower from my car. He was a rear-wheel barker, chased me halfway into town day after day, barking. For what? Dreamer. No matter how or why you do it, you get run down. Oh, God, this is so sad. Yes, it's terrible. Bark is what us dogs do here in Dog Town also. Shit on sidewalks, doormats, porches, trails, wherever new shoes walk fearless. Bark is what us dogs do here in Dog Town. It's a dog's life. We can't live without you. Mirror you, we are you. Beneath your foot or on the garage roof, you teach us speech. Bark, bark. For biscuits, we dance for you. You push us through hoops and see our eyes as your eyes. But you got the guns, the gas, the poison, all of it. Bark. And this is what us dogs do here in Dogtown. Hey, Dimitri. Grandson is being shuttled. I hope not muzzled. Okay. So, I don't want to repeat what Michael did, but I'll just because Michael loves to hear me read this poem, and I'm forced to indulge, you know, in this long-term love of a relationship. All right, almost there.
Repent.
I did that, and it didn't solve anything.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. To what?
I
don't like the world of repenting and that, you know, and that vocabulary. It's binding and constricting and all the rest of it, and it forces you to live an unrealized life.
Yeah.
All right, here we go now. Almost there. Crushed dog. Slammed to death. Whilst stuck in hot bitch. Both went, neither came. Oh, merciful God. Cares not for crushed dog. That's about repenting. I sent him to school, and when he comes back, he can walk with me down any street. Dog eat dog. Can't you see it? Everybody's got a bite on everybody else. Yeah. All right, well, you know, enough of this. You know, of course, the ploy, the trope, dog is what backwards?
God.
Oh, heavy. neutered, spayed, fixed, altered, stud, and bitch walk around in circles, trying to remember something like what to do. This is a poem about imperialism, colonialism, and all of that. I mean, you know, I'm using once again, dog is being abused in the name of higher consciousness. Dog stinks of sea and rain. Lies before the fireplace, ribbons of stink aura steam off his hide. Out, damned spot. Right, have we had enough? Are we like? Totally sated with brilliance and genius.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Okay, let me see if there's anything else. Is there any requests?
Red shoes.
Who said that? You said that, Michael? Okay. All right, okay. All right, this is what Julia Vinograd always wants me to read. So,
wow.
And she's not here, so I do this for her and for whoever asks. It's great to have a book with a table of contents, by the way. I mean, you know, it really makes life a lot easier. Great, I don't know.
It is. It's a wonderful book.
It's a book. Okay, let me see.
I'll get Vinograd
at the conference. Oh, here we go. All right. This is a North Beach poem. You'll recognize all of the places I talk about. And I woke up dancing, out of bed, past kids crying in clusters, mine, hers, anybody else's, piled up, writhing, howling, steamy cracked windows, stink of ancient diapers, sour milk, cartoon rat whiskers, crushed raggedy, broken Fisher-Price homes, uncoiled rabbits, Legos, Tonka trucks, Pacific mold on windowsills, crowing black green alphabet dots, burst to spread and mark monk white walls crazed with Crayola faces. And I danced down the hallway, leapt over the dogs and cats hunting each other for food, who turned to attack me like a corps de ballet. But I was dancing, and I'd never danced before. Music from all the radios propelled me into and out of rooms where my lives erased. And I leapt into space, free of sorrow or thought of art. And she pleaded with me to take her. But I said, no, it wouldn't work. I dance alone. The radios are behind me. And she said, would you leave me with the kids, the rooms, the TV, broken down kitchen, nothing works, muggers, robbers, raiders, clawing at doors, windows, snipers, vipers, pirates, oozing through old keyholes, gurus, prophets, healers, Jehovah's Witnesses, fisting the front door into a tissue. Yes, yes, I yelled, dancing past her down the hall. Yes, yes, the radio's behind me and before me, music more conclusive than the sun, and I dance. down Russian Hill into North Beach, old nicotine, ivory, Italian gentleman, young Italian silk, misogyny, beatnik survivors tubbed in jukebox coffins, drunk on history and hippie holdout, new age hobos piss at the world passing by, bent over double in doorway zoos. And I dance past Broadway's whores, tattered bare butt blushing with belt welts, ravaged vagina, overlit handheld camera, porno film house aisles I dance down, break movie dreamer meditation, break through tough screen, leap a Nijinsky onto a rope, sandbag through iron exit door into day. Dance into city lights, microcosm, feudal culture. Everyone's a poet, but I dance. Everyone's an editor, but I dance. Everybody has a book nobody reads, and I dance. Down an alley into Chinatown, attacked by teenage Bruce Lee, mafia, karate, and 38s. But I leap higher than Confucius, who didn't dance from his hut, his palace, his systems of etiquette. I dance to the city radio, Chien Shanai, cymbal, dragon smash, traffic cardiogram, chop. Off chicken heads, trout scales scraped away, crushed boiled crab shell crunch, ladle day old pork barbecue from stainless steel trays into takeout cardboard cartons, white porcelain Kuan Yin cracks apart, falls on marble bank of Canton floor, cameras on tourists like goiters.
I like that too.
Everyone's amazed when I dance over dim sum trays in black acrobat slippers. I need no food, I'm fueled by dance. Radios in front and back, they're in my ears. My mouth is a radio. Everything I see and hear is music. Everything I say, everything is music. I dance to dance to a mad speed babbler's rat, tapping like crazy. Honey, coals, hold your hat. Fred, watch out. Better believe it, Bubbles. And no trace of sweat, and no thought, and no art. And true to each second, my body moves over the
Do you think your God will let me into heaven after all that I've seen? Do you think your God will let me into heaven after all? Children burning as they ran from a raging earth of madmen, flying by on swords, heard the unheard crying of the wounded mother, crying, crying for God, crying, crying for God. I've seen in the mirror of a fool who erases his mind with easy entertainment, watching the world turn into a movie, crying, crying for God, crying, crying for God. You think your God after all that I've seen.
think you're God will let me into heaven after all that I've seen. And I listen to the incredible, frustrated yelling of a whole tribe of people worn out from trying to make the prophecy free. Crying for God. Crying for God. I see the crippled dwarf kings clinging to the banks of money floating topside of the blood of war to drown out forever and eternally silence.
That was David Meltzer performing with his late wife, Tina. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And thanks for listening. I'm going to close the program with Kathleen Ferrier. Here's to you, David. For Julie.
Blow, bonny breeze, my lover to me. They told me last night there were ships in the offing, and I hurried.